This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Today on Sticks In, we are recapping the PLL weekend in Fairfield, Connecticut. Best weekend of the year. We'll go through each of those games. We'll take a look at kind of what each team also kind of would maybe want to try and do to adjust and either keep things going or turn things around for the second half of the season. Plus, we will talk All-Star Weekend a little bit. All-Star Weekend is in Louisville, so we'll cover the location. We'll talk the roster a little bit, snubs, the format, whole thing. If you are enjoying the pod, please do leave a like, subscribe, leave a positive review, download, rate it, whatever your podcast platform allows you to do. I really do appreciate that. And let's do it. Welcome to a Tuesday episode of the Sticks In Podcast. Happy to have you with me. It is the middle of July, and the PLL regular season is now officially halfway done. Just goes that fast. We're five games in. I think they're starting to look more like a top three or so teams in the league and a bottom two or so teams in the league. And all that really matters is making the postseason. Seven of eight teams do it. Yeah, the top four do go to the championship series, and there's obviously a nice payday for players involved there. But look, neither team that played for the PLL championship a year ago finished top four. So really, teams I think are focused on get yourself in the race. Top seven is where you need to be. Get hot at the right time. Try and burn your way to Philadelphia. Before we get into the games and everything from the weekend, how they did in Connecticut, why Connecticut is awesome, all that good stuff, let's talk All-Star Weekend, because it is All-Star Week. That's what's on tap. That's what's coming up this weekend. So the format for the All-Star game this year is Rising Stars against veterans. To be a Rising Star, I believe I have this right, a player has to be in year three or younger, and everybody else is a veteran. There's fan voting to determine who the All-Stars were. Obviously, fan voting always results in a gigantic turnout from Team Whatabout when voting concludes for time in memoriam. That is how it has always been. I am not always a huge fan of fan voting completely deciding things. It's the way the NBA once had Yao Ming as an all-star starter, despite him never playing a game that season and already declared out for the entire season with injury. It's kind of like just a funky thing how that happens. And it always leads to some results that maybe have you thinking all-star appearances aren't a real meritocracy. And I know it seems like that's maybe not that big a deal, but there are guys in this league with incentive deals in their contracts. And when it comes Hall of Fame time, everyone loves to point to Hall of or all-star appearances. And if you're going to have those kind of things, then you want to make sure there's a way for guys who maybe aren't in front of the fans all the time to also get their deserved opportunity in an All-Star game. So other sports give All-Star coaches the chance to pick a couple of players to add to the team outside of the All-Star voting. That usually ensures that you get some of the guys who are really balling but aren't super popular maybe to still get that recognition. As far as I know, I don't think the PLL does that, but maybe that changes in the future. If they do it, then that would be great. I think that's obviously an ideal practice to have. In this format, as we said, Rising Stars and Veterans, fine by me. I'm going to confess here, I typically don't watch a ton of All-Star games. I watch them for lacrosse, but like in other sports, the Pro Bowl is a joke. The NBA All-Star game isn't all that fun anymore, in my opinion. I don't watch a ton of baseball regardless. Hockey is definitely still a fun one, and the PLL has had some good ones. The reason I think that the PLL and hockey are still good ones is because they play the sport that the All-Star game is in. The hockey guys are out there playing hockey. The PLL guys are out there. They're really playing legitimate lacrosse. In football, whatever they play in the Pro Bowl ain't football. And in basketball, it's basically just a dunk contest with five people on the court. That alone, I think, you know, they tinker with the rules, and the rules can be a little bit, sometimes a little wacky. But for the most part, the guys are out there, and they are legitimately competing in a PLL game. There's a little less contact. Okay. Defense still gets played. Legitimate lacrosse defense is played. Offense is played. Cool stuff happens. There's cool transition. Players show off a little bit. It's what you want from an all-star game. PLL does that well. That alone makes it a better all-star game, I think, than other major sports in some cases. So, you know, rising stars versus veterans, fantasy draft, whatever other way you want to split the teams up, fine by me. Do something like odd draft year versus even draft year, college affiliations, let the ACC and the Big Ten take on everybody, bragging rights, whatever. Split them up by conference. You know, that actually could be fun. I will never really have a gripe with the way in which the teams get made. I do sometimes have a gripe with pure fan voting alone as the way to get guys there. And while I do enjoy the All-Star game itself, some of the other stuff sometimes gets lost on me a little bit. I am old. I readily admit to being old. I know some of the stuff is not targeted to the olds like me. There's a couple that I like. Fastest shot is like the dunk contest in the NBA to me. It's never going anywhere. It never really should. Those nights in the dunk contest, like Aaron Gordon versus Zach LaVine kind of nights, or like the Vince Carter dunk contest, they don't come along often. But when they do, it is unparalleled all-star entertainment. It is so good. It's great on social media. People are tuned in. There's highlights getting clips going out left and right. They're doing incredible things. It's super fun. I think fastest shot can have moments like that. A pair of players going back and forth trying to push this shot towards, you know, 120 miles an hour, whatever they can do. They have that, you know, they get their big windup. They step in, they let it go, and you're like half a second waiting for the number to show up. Is really, really fun and exciting. So I still like the fastest shot contest. What I'm not as crazy about is like the I think they call it the freestyle. I don't know if that's a thing. The skills, whatever, that kind of stuff. It's a goalie standing there motionless for some reason as a player does a whole bunch of wild stuff with a stick and then throws the ball past him. You know, you get the costumes, you get the props. None of that does anything for me. I would imagine the younger demo likes it. I don't know. Maybe it plays well on social, whatever. For me, I don't get it. And it doesn't do, I'm just not that fired up about it. Using the dunk contest as a comparison point again, I remember there was a year the dunk contest, All-Star Weekend was in Atlanta, and one of the players' dunks was just putting on a Dominique Wilkins jersey and dunking the ball. Like that was it. That's dumb. That does nothing. There's nothing extra athletic about putting on a Dominique Wilkins jersey. So, you know, I like to see more than just like, it's a goofy prop, and then he did something. I don't know. It doesn't do much for me. But I will continue to maintain that PLL Sharks and Minnows, if you know the classic swimming pool game Sharks and Minnows, with the top five cause turnover players in the league serving as the Sharks, and every all-star midfielder serving as Minnows, would be electric television entertainment. Carry the ball past the Sharks from sideline to sideline. You get stripped. You're out. Last MIDI Alive wins. Tell me you wouldn't watch that. Tell me that wouldn't be fun as hell. So I mentioned Team What About. I'm going to put on my Team What About jersey here for a second. And again, the fan voting thing, sometimes you have a couple of guys who should probably be on an all-star list but didn't make it. You might know them as snubs. My rule, as always, and it's always the rule for all-stars or any All-Americans, any team thing, if you're saying a guy was a snub, you have to say whose spot they should take. You have to put one on, one out. That said, particularly for PLL, some players don't have their highlights and their persona pumped on social a ton. Others just don't want to have it. Some guys just don't have a play that lends themselves to it. Some guys just don't want to be the guy that's all over social. They just want to play and be successful, and that's it. As such, there are some guys that I did want to definitely mention that these guys should be all-stars. These are all-star players. Graham Hossack is at the very worst. Like, if he's out there playing hurt and having a bad day, he's a top three defenseman on earth. he races someone every week. He was crushing doubles last weekend and bottling up Ryder Garnsey in Connecticut. That a week after Cross Ferreira was all anybody could talk about in week one. Guess who he saw week two? Graham Hossack. Hossack gave him zeros. The only time you've probably seen Graham Hossack on social this year or anything like that is when he took the Shining Twins pick with Sisselberger. But otherwise, you're not going to hear his name a ton. He doesn't command or maybe even want all that much attention. You won't see him on social. Go ahead and pick literally any defender on the Vets team and replace that player with Graham Hossack. I don't think you'd hear a complaint from a single PLL player. He's too good. He's absolutely too good. It's insane to not have him there. Archers fans, I'm sorry it gets wilder from there. Latrell Harris didn't get a nod either. Again, he's not a guy with a ton of pub on social. And when you do fan stuff and it's all driven via social, they're not going to see Latrell Harris. They're not going to vote for Latrell Harris. So, look, he's fresh off an award-winning NLL season. He is the top SSDM on the Archers, who have a great short stick D midfield unit. On that team, the young guns or the rising stars team, that's a tough roster to crack because Tarasenko and Logan are there. But I think voters could kind of pick the positions that they wanted. Like you could just vote for like 10 guys kind of thing, regardless of position, I think was how it went. I might be wrong, but SSDM is always going to be tough in that regard. Treasy's an all-pro level player. And if you're an all-pro without being an all-star, that's funny to me. But on the Vet side, where the hell is Zed Williams? I mean, where is Zed Williams, folks? Zed Williams is not an all-star? We're talking about, he's the only Zed Williams I know of. He's had a game fewer than everybody else. He still has as many points as Chris Gray or Will Manny. He has more than Sowers. He has more than Connor Fields, who also didn't make it. What? He has more than Matt Rambo. Zed is one of the most special playmakers the sport has. He is one of the only other guys in the league that's at the Josh Byrne level of something awesome could happen any second here as soon as he gets the ball. He's a perfect all-star game player. Zed's got to be there. Has to be. I think Rambo, the injury that he picked up in Connecticut, it looks like it's probably going to keep him from playing in the all-star game. I hope Zed gets to take his teammate's spot. I hope Zed gets to take that spot. I will say, last guy I want to have in there, I think Brian Menekes should be there. I realize I have the Connecticut bias, but I don't know how you can watch that Atlas game, and I know voting was closed when it got played or whatever, and not want to have him there. He torched Brett Makar twice in the first two possessions he had the ball, and Atlas switched the matchup immediately. Tried Adler. I have never seen, in all the years I watched him at Cornell and, you know, kind of watching as much as I could and everything to kind of get ready for this year, but I don't think I've ever seen Gavin Adler get sent the wrong way or get his feet tangled. Not once. Minikis basically did that in Connecticut. Made his knees kind of shake up a little bit. After a while, Atlas didn't just play with it. Just didn't have a guy behind the goal. Just let Minikis stand back there. They played all six guys above the goal. They tried to turn him into a feeder, and if he came at them, he tried to just beat him at goal line. He threw that dime to Ryan Smith that resulted in one of the cleanest behind the backs you'll ever see. The All-Star format is perfect for Brian Minikis. He cranks out speed, highlights if defenders getting beat. It's the kind of thing that, again, PLL loves those things for social. It's all anybody wants to see happen in an All-Star game. I don't think anybody can do speed highlights like that except maybe Sowers, and it's incredible. The only rising star attackman I could say isn't legitimately really outplaying Brian Minikis right now is T. I think I'd take him ahead of Wisnowskis right now. I don't know. I might even take him ahead of Chris Gray. Like, I really think that's where I have Brian Minikis in terms of the way he's playing today, this week. Anyway, I don't want to keep doing the what about thing. There's always going to be stubs. I hope guys, you know, I'm sure guys are going to drop for injuries, lack of availability. It happens every year. Some of these guys are going to get a look. You know, Jackson Morrill, a guy who's been really good, probably worthy of consideration. You know, Ty Warner, plenty of really good players. But anyway, rosters aside and all that aside, let's talk location a little bit. Location's Louisville. When they announced this, I was cool with it as an idea, right? If you want to test markets, I think All-Star Games are the best way to do it. I'm not sure how likely it would be for the PLL to go to Louisville for like a week 3 regular season game. right? You might not expect a huge crowd, maybe not a huge hotbed. I know Bellarmine's there on the men's side. Louisville for the women's program is obviously big. It's close enough to Ohio to get some of those fans, but you know, not your traditional hotbed by any means. The All-Star game probably moves the needle a little bit more. And the All-Star game has drawn well just about every year. It rates well on TV every year. People like it. I think some people were kind of down on the location. They didn't understand Louisville, but as a choice, they didn't think it would be any fun. But yeah, good old Nick Cosello making the good case for it. Players want to go to a place where they can have a good time, where it's going to be fun. And it's probably really easy to have a good time in Louisville. I've never been, but it seems like a city that could be fun. So, look, other pro leagues move that All-Star game around. I think as the PLL starts moving towards local markets, and that's, you know, it gets further down kind of the plan there, that, you know, moving the All-Star game around should continue to happen. Try new markets that way. That's my All-Star bit. I will be watching. Again, the lacrosse All-Star game is always good because they actually play the game. They play the sport like a regular season game for the most part. Like, there's not going to be like 10 mans and super hard rides and you know, all that kind of crazy stuff, but they compete and they play to win. That's all you can ask for out of an All-Star game. And they make it fun to watch. That alone, again, makes it one of the best around for me. Week 5 in Fairfield. I think we learned a lot. I think we can go through the 4 games here real quick. We can kind of talk about each a little bit. If you came to Connecticut, I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope my guide to the food and to the things to do here near and around the stadium helped you. I hope you went and got a little Country Cow breakfast sandwich, maybe hit Gaetano's for a little deli. Maybe you hit up the Sea Grape and had yourself a night. It only happens there. I know I hit Hoodoo with Jordy and had an absolute feast. I hit Archie Moore's for some wings. I was really on it, trying to have myself a good time. I know the PLL folks crushed a ton of Colony Pizza. Good for them. I hope they enjoyed it. That hot oil doesn't miss. The atmosphere at Rafferty at Fairfield U was obviously incredible both days. They sold out Saturday or Friday ahead of time. They sold out Saturday morning. So there were people coming up to the window on Saturday and getting turned away. There was no more room. Bleachers on both sides packed. People lining the fence. People sitting up on the grassy hill areas on the far side bleachers. The bar down was in the far end of the stadium from where you walk in on. That was packed. There were people moving around all over the place. The field level was jumping. I'm telling you, I know how much I shill for Connecticut and how much I love it and how much I wanted to have a team. I really think it's really hard to look at what Connecticut has brought out to the PLL, not just this year, but last year, and not have them right there as a market that should be a home market for somebody. Fairfield U in particular. I think the school does a great job partnering with the league. You know, it really is a great environment. Really is cool. So, to the games themselves, first game of the weekend that started us off was Waterdogs 16, Whipsnakes 13. Weekend kicked off with the Waterdogs getting their rings. Steve DiNapoli and Ryan Brown were there for the festivities. Got big hugs from everyone. It was a cool little reunion to see that going down. They spent a bit of time in the Bar Down Lounge as well. Billy Football was there to collect the rings for the Pardon My Take crew for Big Cat and PFT. A very cool event. Coach Copeland said after the game that it was one of these kind of surreal things where all of his worlds were colliding. He had the Water Dogs practice at Greenwich Country Day School, where he's the head coach. And then he got his PLL championship ring and played a pro game at Fairfield U, where he was, you know, a coach for a very long time. So kind of a cool moment for him for all those things to come together. You can hear more from Coach Copeland if you check out Quotables up on the Sticks Insight now. Kind of all the post-game quotes from everybody from every team. I transcribe them and I drop them on Sticks Insight. You can check those out if you haven't. But Water Dogs had no Connor Kelly, no Ryan Conrad. And once again, no face-off specialist. 2 weeks in a row. They really ran away with this game in the second half, turning up the heat kind of on the net a little bit. Jack Hanna had a great game. He bombed a two-pointer. He was excellent in his first game back off the pup list. Brian Phipps called into action after what looked like a very scary injury to Kyle Bernlohr. The word is that Bernlohr may be able to actually return before the end of the regular season this year, which is unbelievably good news for Whips fans in particular, and of course for Kyle himself, for it to not be that serious. I mean, a month or whatever, you know, 5 games off is a big deal, but for it to not be more than that after what it looked like, I think you get a sigh of relief there for sure. In the meantime, it's probably going to be Fipper starting, I would imagine. Brendan Krebs is on the roster. The Whips are one of the only teams in the league that rostered three goalies before this. So I would bet you get a Bernlohr to IR kind of move, and then you get Phipps and Krebs as the goalies. Unfortunately, it looks like injury news doesn't stop there. Matt Rambo did injure his hand late in this game. There hasn't been much of an official word to come down yet. I have heard some rumors that it could be some time missed for him, a couple of weeks worth of time at least, so before he's able to return. Look, when it rains, it pours for them. I don't know. It's just a brutal beat. It's just that kind of year for the Whips. They're so snake bit, but no pun intended. Keegan Conn, I thought, was able to do some really nice things on offense for the Whips in this one. I think out of necessity, they needed somebody to create. He stepped up in that regard. I would imagine his role expands a good amount if Rambo does have to miss much time and if Brad Smith isn't able to return from knee tendonitis sometime soon. So otherwise, the weight of this offense is going to fall on Zed and Tucker Dordovic. And that, you know, Zed is obviously tremendous. Tucker has been incredible. He's the heavy favorite for Rookie of the Year in the sports books. But that's still, it's one guy and a rookie to lean your whole offense on. It's tough to win with just two guys that can create. You know, Michael Earhart still banged up, barely seen Brad Smith, Bernlohr, Rambo. It's a crazy list. You know, after the game, the two coaches, Staggs and Copeland, were passing each other on their way into and out of the press conference area. And Copeland just patted Staggs on the back and just said, "Get healthy, man." You can tell it's like he's feeling for him. Like, it's just unbelievable what that Whipsnakes team is going through on the injury front this year. So the Water Dogs, they moved to 4-1, have a week off now to get Connor Kelly back from the PUP list to join their roster. They continue to go without a faceoff, man. In Dallas, they play the Archers. It's hard to imagine them deciding now to change their plan and dress one against Sisselberger. Although Sis has been the most difficult to run what Greg Garanlian calls it the face-off prevent. It's tough to run that against this. You know what? This hasn't really been talked about yet, and it's something that I've been kind of trying to try and understand better, but I can't imagine what the phone call every week is like for guys like James Riley and Zach Tucci to get. You aren't dressing because we like our chances better by skipping your position completely. That has to be so hard to hear. Brutal to hear. And for 2 weeks in a row. You know, for now it's working for them, and I guess if it ain't broke, but that's really tough on those two guys in particular to hear that news week after week, and I would imagine hear it again in Dallas. Water Dogs have two games remaining against the Archers in the second half of the season. They also play the Cannons, Chaos, and Atlas in the second half, so four of their five games against top four teams, and two games against number one, against the Archers, who are running the show right now. I think the Water Dogs still have a great shot at that first round bye and that top spot. They will have to knock the Archers off to do it. And that's a tall task, but those games will be good. That first one, right after the All-Star break, Dallas, Water Dogs Archers will be a gem. I think the Whips are basically in just don't finish last territory. Only the eighth place team misses the playoffs. Whips talent is too good for me to think that's where they end up, though. I can't imagine them finishing last. As we've said, they need to get healthy and just have that. Having a consistent lineup every week makes such a difference in the PLL. These guys do not get a ton of time to practice together and to do anything other. You know, they study film as a group during the week, but remotely, to get on the field and practice together does not happen very often. It happens the day before the game. They travel into the city they're playing in, they get a practice in, they play. If you're changing your lineup all the time and guys can't get used to each other and develop together, it's really, really hard to play against a team that does have that. And the Whips just can't get that. They can't get that consistent lineup. So that's why the performance has kind of become inconsistent for them. But you know, in the past years, Chaos were always this team who kind of lost a bunch of regular season games and then charged through the playoffs. I think that can be the Whips this year. I think if they can hang around the middle of the table and just make sure they're in the race at the end. If they get healthy at the end, nobody will want to play them. I guarantee it. Next up, Friday night, late game, Archers 10, Redwoods 3. Yikes, 3. Let's start with the good, I guess, the Archers. I'd say they're the class of the league right now. I think they are the top of the league. If you want to try and find a knock on them, you can say they haven't played a super tough schedule. Their wins are Chrome, Whips, Cannons, and Redwoods. Three of those are bottom half teams. Their loss is the Chaos. That was by 5 goals. It's really 3 goals. There's a two-pointer on an empty net at the end to close it out, but score differential matters. But, you know, in terms of the actual competing in the game. But they did do that with no Grand Amat, which is noteworthy. Archers really didn't change a ton week to week. They share the ball. They play fast. They shoot well. The biggest question for them from past years has been answered in a big way by Mike Sisselberger, who's not only winning draws, but can beat that prevent on his own. The offense here being good, though, really isn't news. I think we all saw it from week one on. It's good. It's deep. And I honestly, because of how well they do the next man up, I don't know if they miss a beat if that Matt Moore injury results in him missing time or not. I think they can beat anyone. They can just put their next guy in and still be deadly. The story in this one for me, or a big part of it, was on the Archers' side of the ball, was their defense. They showed you exactly what they will do to a team that doesn't match them physically very well, and a team who just tries to sit in the dodge too much. Hossack is, as we said before, a monster. He was all over Garnsey. Warren Jeffrey was physical, I thought, with Pennell, played his angles very well, and drove Pennell to the parts of the field that they wanted Pennell to go to. Anytime Pennell, or any Dodger really on the team, you know, it happened to Jules a couple times, or even Ryder, and if they held the ball too long, that double was coming hard, and it was staying on. And that was, I think, a big part of kind of the plan and the scheme for them, was they forced some turnovers in this just by having their slide stay on it because the ball wasn't going to move. That Redwoods player would draw the slide and then wasn't able to move the ball out of it, and they would just get crunched by a double. So that, coupled with their, as usual, excellent short stick D-Mitty play, was just smothering. Redwoods went scoreless for 34 minutes and 8 seconds. They scored with 10:08 left in the second quarter, and that was it. They tied themselves for the lowest total in the PLL game. The Woods are playing, in that game, they were playing with the stickiest ball known to man. There were so many possessions where only a couple of guys touched the ball. You know, post-game, Coach Nat said, if you can't get into a rhythm and you can't find a flow on your offense, all these guys are superstars. They all want to make a play, and sometimes that hurts more than it helps. And I think that's what happened here. I paraphrased that from that. It was pretty close to that, though. Everyone looked like they wanted to try and be the one to make the play to change the game, and they were calling their own number to do it because they're such a dynamic offensive weapon. And the Archers were saying, okay, we'll play 6 versus you. Okay. And that's kind of what you saw for basically the second half. The other questions abound for the Woods postgame, as you can imagine, were around the midfield. Sergio Perkovic doesn't have a point yet. Miles is 3-for-20 shooting. He doesn't have an assist yet. Neither guy looks all that effective. Sergio, I thought, had a couple of decent looks in that, but couldn't put one home. How long they can stay in the lineup with that level of production, which is to say basically no production, is the question. Cole Kearse looks solid. DeMeo is a good shooter and a good off-ball player. Maybe Nekai can deliver a little more offensive production if he used that way. You know, the Woods will have to, and that said they would, look at everything. Everything. Not just personnel, everything. There have been some takes out there about the Woods trading for help. Here's my thing with the trading for help. You know how we're all watching these games and being like, man, the Woods really need some help in the midfield. You know who else sees that? Every PLL coach. And no other team is in the business of trying to solve the Redwoods problem for them without getting a massive return. Trading a player to help the Woods deal with their midfield problem is not something other teams, if it was me, if I'm the GM, it's not something I'm considering unless you wow me with what's coming back. Ryan Conrad was the name out there, and I know I kind of went into this on Twitter a little bit, but the Water Dogs have no reason to trade Ryan Conrad. They have a ton of good midfielders. They won't be able to dress them all every weekend. That is not a problem for the Water Dogs. That's fine. You don't dress everybody every weekend. And the PLL, which is stacked with attackmen, converted attackmen playing midfield, having that many versatile midfielders is a blessing. It's such an edge over other teams. Unloading them without getting some huge overpay for them just doesn't seem like a sound strategy to me. You know, the idea that a guy might be involved in a trade because he doesn't make the roster a lot it doesn't matter that he doesn't make the roster a lot. That's not a good reason to trade somebody, because he doesn't make your roster all the time. That guy might not be playing for you. He's not playing against you either. He isn't solving someone else's personnel problem. Yes, it sucks stashing guys. It's tough to tell them. It's tough for them to swallow not getting a game check. It's tough for all those reasons. But, hey, look, man, you've seen Jerry Maguire. Bob Sugar said it. It ain't show friends, it's show business. That's what pro sports is. Ryan Conrad is a Team USA midfielder. Trading him to a team that really needs a Team USA midfielder all but certainly helps that team more than it helps you. So why do it? Take that reasoning and apply it to any other PLL team. All those Water Dogs midfielders, none of them are about to be free agents. They're not walking after this year. You play them in enough games to get them above your 30%, which is not hard, because there's more than enough games left for some of them. And you got all your guys back. Yes, stashing them, I know, it sucks. They don't get to play every week. We want to see them play every week. A guy not playing every week is not a reason to trade him. You're also always an injury away from that guy who doesn't play a lot, playing a ton. For a lot of teams, that guy that they have knows their system, knows their culture, is accepted by the locker room. You don't want to just deal a guy because he's not playing for you every week. He plays for you most weeks, some weeks. That alone is enough reason to keep him. You don't want to go out there and trade for trade's sake to solve somebody else's problem. If I'm another GM and I'm looking at the problems that the Woods are having, I'm saying I want them to continue having them. I don't want to solve that problem for them. Barring, again, some outlandish overpay where I get back like a comical amount of draft picks. Because for any of my players, if you want to say I have a price, it's that. A bunch of picks. Like, that offer has to include multiple draft picks and first rounders at that. The upcoming draft has Brendan O'Neill, Connor Schellenberger, probably Pat Cavanaugh, Matt Brandau, even more weapons than that. It's we've said it before, it's the 2003 NBA draft of lacrosse drafts. Teams should not be parting with their first-round picks in this draft. And all of this, to me, adds up to just a trade not really working here. Or if it does, more than likely very strange or very bad trade for somebody. The trade deadline is August 22nd at 2 p.m. The Woods can wait a little bit. They don't need to acquire a midfielder this week. Does finishing eighth suck? Yeah, it does. I don't think the Woods are finishing eighth. Even if they manage to. Like, if their defense totally falls apart, because their defense is still awesome, their goalie is still awesome, they still have TD, they would need a complete collapse on every level, at every personnel group, I think, to finish eighth. Even if that manages to happen, you know what they get for that? Brendan O'Neill. Enjoy. The Woods need to figure out what to do with what they have and what's in the player pool, I think. See if they can get some offensive flow back. They've had a few games with it. It's in them to play well. They've had good offensive performances. But they need to get out of... The challenge for them is when it gets bad out there, we cannot start playing hero ball. That's when it starts getting tough and it just compounds if the defense stops them. Their defense is still as good as anybody's in the league for me. The pieces are there. I don't think the Woods need to be in... trade for a guy, acquire a guy, do this, do that. And it all feels hasty to me right now. Enough on that. Next game, Cannons 12, Chrome 6. So an under game. It's interesting. Got this called out on social too by Guranlian, but the games where a team declines to dress a face-off specialist from the jump, not jumps into the strategy mid-game, but goes into the game with no face-off guy, I think they've all gone under. I think you wind up with just clock getting eaten and just a slower game as a result, which is hilariously ironic given the spirit of the rule change. But anyway, Cannons, I thought kind of were all over this one from jump. Up 4-1 after the first, up 7-2 with the half. They felt pretty in control. the Canons went, again, with no faceoff specialist. They went with defensive depth instead. They dressed six poles and three shorties, plus Jeff Traynor, who can play on both ends for them. So, you know, I appreciated the strategy for them. I think they tried it, or they didn't try it. They did it against the Atlas with Ethan Rall taking 17 faceoffs in that game. And they had success with the forcing Trevor backwards. I think in postgame, Coach Holman said they saw what Water Dogs did to Chrome with no faceoff specialists, and they thought they would try it as well. So it was the same thing with Ethan Rall taking, you know, a good bunch of the draws. He took 14. Matt Reese took 8. They won 4 between them, which, I mean, good for them. It's more than you would think they would win. But, you know, the depth is what starts to show to me now as a major game changer in it. All those pulls and shorties meant that at the end of the game, especially, you know, Coach Holman mentioned this too. He knew it was going to be a hot day, a hot evening. It's going to be humid. Having the depth on defense meant late in the game, your defenders are fresh, and that's what you need. Those guys are not sucking wind. They're not dehydrated. They're feeling okay. So, you know, I think that's a part of the strategy that didn't get considered at first, but is now becoming evident as a big part of it, is your defense stays fresh the whole game if you do this, and that's where you decide to go with depth. Another part of this, Ethan Rall, again, played an exceptional game for me, caused 3 turnovers, won 3 ground balls. Matt Reese, again, the other guy taking the faceoffs, caused 2 turnovers. A critical part of this, of what we're starting to call the prevent, is you need to be able to generate turnovers off of those backwards exits from the opposing faceoff guy. Teams are having success doing it with Connor Farrell. So I would say watch the team that plays the Chrome every week, and if they don't have one of those mega dominant guys, then maybe they consider trying to do it too. But, you know, of all that defensive – look, the Canons caused 10 turnovers in this game, which is a ridiculous number. 10 caused turnovers is incredibly high, and it's the story of the game really is those turnovers. Coach Sudan said as much in postgame. They kept turning the ball over and killing themselves. Even when they tried to get something good going, they would score and then turn it over. Canons take their turnover, go down and score. But Canons caused 10 turnovers. 9 of them were caused by those defensive personnel, as you would expect. It wasn't a ton of ride backs or midfield play or anything like that. It's all Rall, Reese, Hartzell. Bubba Fairman had one. Pulver's got one. Jack Keelty's got one. You know, Max Wayne didn't have one, but picked up 5 ground balls. These guys were everywhere. The pulls were everywhere. I'll tell you the coolest play of the game, though, for the Canons perspective, for sure. With about, I'm going to say there were like 30, 40 seconds. I'd have to go back and look at how much time is left, but it felt like a good amount. A flag hits the ground. The Canons are on defense. Chrome have the ball. Canons foul. So the Canons, if they pick the ball up and take possession, then there's a whistle and the penalty gets enforced and Chrome goes to the man up. The score at that point is very much, the game is decided, but the ball hits the ground and Ethan Rall is next to it and he doesn't pick it up because that'll stop the clock and he knows that. Instead, he's literally out there playing hockey. He starts swiping it upfield away from the goal. Just swiping it away from Chrome players towards the middle of the field as best as he can. He's kicking it. He's knocking it with his stick. He's not picking it up, and he just starts eating clock and seconds just tick off. And eventually he starts kind of getting surrounded by Chrome players who are trying to get the ball back too, and he kind of just knocks it back towards the corner. He eats the entire rest of the game clock without ever taking possession of the ball and very much also being in control of the ball at the same time. It was one of the smartest plays you'll ever see a player make, and this is from a rookie, an undrafted rookie. Just an incredible play. Holman, after the game, you know, was happy to talk about it because he was saying, look, if it's a one-goal game and he does that, you talk about that like it's like a historic, like an all-timer of a play to kill that game. And that's really like that level of intelligence and athleticism is what it was. It was incredible. So Ethan Rall is looking like a steal and a great find for the Canons. Again, undrafted somehow. I would imagine he went undrafted because he is on the smaller side, but like he's out there making a difference, man. He's out there making a difference. So he's a big part of this Canons team now, this Canons strategy for sure. For Chrome, I think, you know, there was some good stuff out of this game. I know they're on a skid here. But look, Sean Scannone played a great game. 15 stops in this one. That's a great outing from your goalie. 55% save percentage. Like, if a goalie puts up those numbers, then you're probably doing okay. Sam Hanley's best game as a pro. Hat trick, an assist, shot over 40%. Committed a couple early turnovers, and as we said, the story of the game was the turnovers. Another high turnover game for Nick Turin is not what you want to see. 5 turnovers for him. It's kind of comes with the territory when he does so much feeding and distributing, but it's really just high numbers in that category. Jesse King made his debut. He had a goal. Morrill had a goal. But, the turnover numbers were just entirely too high. Something that was also interesting, Farrell, yes, 16 of 18 facing off as they were, the Canucks again didn't dress somebody. But the Chrome also sent Messenger out for a few, and they had Tarasenko take one too. And I think that's one of the ways they're trying to evaluate countering the no faceoff thing is, well, we just won't use Farrell then. Because Messenger and Tarasenko can win faceoffs. Terry took them in college a little bit. Messenger, has them in the indoor game. I think it's another way to do it that we haven't seen a ton of yet. Usually it revolves around moving your personnel away from the faceoff spot to do it, but just trying to win it without your specialist either, win it with Terry and let him play offense, or Messenger and let him play offense. It's another way to kind of combat the subbing and getting your guys on. So very interesting stuff there from Chrome. I would imagine they're going to be the team that you see lead in kind of the experimentation against the faceoff prevent, because it seems like teams are leaning into trying to do it against Connor Farrell in particular. Last game of the weekend, Chaos 15, Atlas 11. So the Atlas skid continues here a bit. They dropped to 1-4. They hung tough in this game. They were up at halftime, 7-6. And then, it was funny. The post-game press conferences start with the whoever's there kind of making an opening statement and giving their thoughts about the game and all that. And Pressler kind of got right to what I thought was the heart of the game as well. I thought he kind of nailed it. Atlas are up 7-6 at half, and in the first, 4 minutes or so of the third quarter, it was, Atlas hit a pipe or turned the ball over, Chaos go down and score. Atlas win the next faceoff, turnover, empty possession, Chaos go down and score. 3 times in a row. And it goes from 7-6 to 9-6. And then Chris Gray stops it to make it 9-7. But, that stretch to start the second half, in that moment, you felt like the Chaos really took control of the game. And they had a huge third quarter. They scored 7 goals in the third. So that third quarter, I felt like, was the defining part of the game. The Atlas made some lineup changes in this one. Drake Porter got the start in net over Jack Concannon. Coach Pressler said it was just a case of Jack just going through a tough spot right now. He's like, look, I've seen D1 athletes have it, All-Americans have it happen. It just happens sometimes. He's not on his game, and they made the switch. So he said he liked the way Drake Porter played, said he stole some. So we'll see kind of what they do week to week after this. I didn't get the impression that this was a permanent every week switch. It could be, but we'll kind of see how they do things. I think the other change you saw was Kobe Smith made his debut for the Atlas at LSM. In post-game, Pressler thought he said he played pretty well. He described Kobe as obviously an offensive-minded LSM. He said he's an offensive player who just happens to be carrying a long pole, basically. Kobe rung that 2 off the pipe early in the game, and that would have been a huge juice goal and obviously a great moment for him too. But, that was just one of those nights where that kind of happens. How they handle that position going forward is tricky, because you kind of get the sense that, okay, Adler, Makar, Rexrode, and Durkin are going to be in the lineup every week. Those are going to be at the 4. So the next one is, it's been Craig Chick for basically the whole season. They gave Kobe the spot this week, but I don't know if it depends on what you're trying to create in the game or game plan, because going defense to offense in transition and as an offensive threat, Kobe Smith is the better player. On the defensive end, like in coverage and, you know, on a wing, maybe even Craig Schick is the better player. So do you, to me, it's kind of game plan dependent, which one of those guys you kind of want. If you feel like all your other matchups feel pretty safe, Adler, Makar, Durkin, Rexrode, they're all going to win their matchups, then maybe you go with Kobe to try and spark your offense a little bit. But, you know, the offense for them hasn't really been the problem. It's been team defense for them that's the problem. And again, I thought, you know, 15 goals is a lot, but I did think they were a little bit better this week. Obviously, Trevor continues to crush it facing off. This wasn't a game where he got, you know, the ball conceded to him a ton of times. He faced off against Nick Rowlett 28 times. Nick Rowlett went 7 of 28. Trevor finished the game 23 of 29. So he continues to dominate at a level that's absolutely incredible. But the Atlas need to find a way to take that and turn it into wins. I know there's the talk about face-off and its reduced impact. You look at it every week, and it's hard not to see it. But, you know, they need to find the way to keep translating Trevor's performances into Ws. For the Chaos, I thought the story of the night was Brian Minikas. Again, CT homer all you want, but look, the kid had 5 points, 3 goals, 2 assists. He could have had more in the first quarter. Towers mentioned that in postgame. He dusted Brett Makar twice on his first 2 touches. And from the field, they had the media down on the field for this one. From down there, you could hear Towers yelling to him, keep bringing it, Minnow. Keep bringing it, Minnow. He was just going to lean on it. Atlas put Gavin Adler on Josh Byrne to start the game, which is probably what I would have done too. And Chaos were content to be like, well, okay, we'll use Minikas and win the matchup there. And it did. And then, you know, it was a matchup switch of Adler to Minikas. Minikas even crossed Adler up one time in a way that I have never seen happen to Gavin Adler. It really was an incredible night for Minikas with the hat trick and the 2 assists. He had the gigantic cheering section. You know, the guys with their shirts off. I'm pretty sure I saw Logan McGovern up there. He was another guy you'll see in the PLL sometime soon. You know, it was quite the environment for a team with as strong a Connecticut connection as the Chaos have. So Dane Smith back in midfield in this game, and it's clear that he can seamlessly move to anywhere. It was funny because in past weeks, you know, Towers had talked about how much he likes Smith at attack because he gets to be out there for transition and he's, you know, you one of your best players, so you want him on the field all the time. But, you know, this week it was Ty Kurtz at attack. Dane Smith still had a goal and 3 helpers, man. 3 assists for the guy. He's always going to be a good feeder. You can play him anywhere. You know, 3 more points for Josh Byrne. Kyle Jackson, 2 goals. They had a lot of guys in the scoring column in this one. Costa Beal had a goal in front of his hometown crowd, which was awesome. You love to see that. You know, the Chaos, I still look at them, and I still see just a really complete team. At the end of the day, you got Blaze Reardon, and you have the defense they have, and now the offense is coming together in a way that's just downright scary, to be honest. When this gets down to its regular 19 consistently in the lineup every week of guys who are comfortable and in it together, then I really think they're a scary team. I think they can challenge for a title again. I really do like the look of the Chaos. I'm very bullish on them. So those are the games for the week. That is the show for the week. I appreciate you coming back and joining me today. Again, check out the PLO quotables from Fairfield, which is all of the post-game quotes from players, from coaches, talking about every topic that there was after the games, is up now at sticksandlacrosse.com. Left some more content for you this week, and it's going to be kind of focused on, you know, what we need to see happen in the second half and some big things that are happening there. So keep an eye out for that over on the website and, of course, on social too. And thank you again for joining me and for sticking around, and we'll see you next time.
Who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.